ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
AI may not be coming for your job, but it's probably going to change how you do it. So how can you redesign your role? Hello, I'm Lisa Leong with ABC Radio National's This Working Life, helping to make your work life better. In the past, your job description and the list of tasks involved in doing it has been pretty fixed. So let's learn what it takes to redesign a job that incorporates AI for better productivity and employee well-being. Professor Sharon Parker is the Director of the Centre for Transformative Work Design at Curtin University. Hello, Sharon.
Hi, Lisa. Great to be here.
There's a lot of headlines in the news about AI taking jobs out of the system. What's your take on that narrative, Sharon?
I guess we've known for quite some time. Some big economists have identified that really AI carries out tasks rather than whole jobs. So we're not really seeing whole jobs disappearing or whole occupations. We're actually seeing tasks within jobs and roles. So that inevitably brings to the fore this question of work design, because you've got to think about, okay, within the set of tasks that are being carried out, what might the AI sensibly carry out versus the human versus both of them together?
And then what's the critical thing we need to think about when it comes to the use of AI at work?
It's the actual use of it at work, which sounds obvious. So I'll give a very simple example, and this is a real example investigated by one of my PhD students, Annika Mertens. So looking at fairly simple AI software, so using software to convert talking into text, using it in a hospital because you've got overloaded doctors, you've got too much to do. Wouldn't it be wonderful if this very accurate technology can be used so that doctors don't have to type up their notes? It can all just be automated. The reality is that technology comes into the work. First of all, it's a noisy environment. The doctors are usually working with lots of noise, lots of turbulence, so it's not necessarily just picking up the single voice. Second, doctors sometimes like to type their notes confidentially so that the patient is not hearing what they're writing down. Of course, if you say it, then, you know, it's not confidential anymore. Third, there's all this unique language that isn't already embedded into the data because it's medical language and so on. So the data needs to be trained, which means the very, very busy doctor has to do that training. So that's what I mean by sort of it has to be embedded into the workflow to make any actual difference. In this case, despite the fact that there was a good plan, the doctors were trained in the technology, everyone thought it might be valuable. In this case, after a six-month trial, it was actually abandoned and decided it wasn't worth all of the extra hassle and investment. Sometimes people are going in search of a problem with this is the technology, now let's solve the problem, instead of what's the problem that we've got in the workflow, what's the issue, and now what might help to solve it.
And I know that AI is also being used to sub out some managers when it comes to automation of decision making. Can you give us some examples of what can go wrong doing that?
And that's probably, one of the biggest issues, because the thing that's sort of unique about AI, I guess, is ultimately that it can learn and be self-managing, which implies it is the one that's in control as opposed to the human. And so people talk about this concept of the human being in the loop. And what they mean by that is the human in the system to be able to make judgments and make decisions when that's appropriate. And so I guess what we've seen historically, and we will see it more and more with AI, is situations where people are taken out of the loop, the workers are taken out of the loop, and then there are, significant consequences. I'll give an example. It's not AI, it's automation, but the same phenomena we're seeing with AI. When the Boeing 737 MAX aeroplane crashed, this was back in, 2018, thereabouts, hundreds of people died in this crash. Relatively soon after, the exact same plane crashed again and several hundred more people died. Suddenly, it's very clear it's not just pilot error. What happened in that particular case? And there's a lot of detail that I won't go into, but the people had installed some new technology, and the point of the technology was to, the planes had been made a bit heavier for to try and make get more people in for the same cost and so on. And so there's some automatic technology had been put in to sort of push the nose of the plane down if it started sort of going up too much. And what happened, if you look at the analyses of those, the first case in the black box, the nose went down, the pilot pushed it up, the nose went down the 21 times before the plane crashed. Well, why? Why didn't the pilot just override it? Well, basically, the pilots didn't even know it was in there. It had been considered a technical change. Let's just put it in. So they hadn't been told about it. They certainly hadn't been trained about it. And they certainly had no autonomy to override it. You know, so if we're going to have automated decision making, you have to be very, very sure that it's okay, that there is not a human checking at some level. And, you know, if you think, well, I gave the example of medical context before, if you think about automated decisions in a medical context, who's legally liable when a wrong decision is made?
Well, I always blame Siri. It's always Siri's fault, just letting you know.
Excellent. So we just need to track down who's behind Siri, who's manipulating Siri in the background.
Exactly. Now, Sharon, you were awarded an Australian Research Council grant to focus on quality work in the digital age. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. We're super, super happy and proud about that.
So can you tell us about this, quality work in the digital age?
Yeah, because the sort of things that we've been talking about are, you know, partly about getting AI to be effective, you know, so for whatever purpose it's being purchased, can we actually design the work so that it delivers value, whether it's diagnosing disease or predicting crime, whatever it's actually doing. But one of the things we also really, really need to look at is what is the impact on people's work quality? Because there are quite a few examples of where, you know, the sorts of things that I've been talking about where humans sometimes their role changes in work, not from being the one making the decisions, but perhaps sitting back and monitoring a system that is doing it and making decisions. So you can see that's a change in people's role. And we actually, we see some examples where AI makes people's work better. And more interesting and more meaningful and easier. But we also see examples where AI makes people's work worse.
And so this centre is really dealing at things at the system level. So you're looking at sort of wider change here, Sharon?
Yeah, and we use the concept of socio-technical. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that concept.
Go deeper on it for us.
Yeah, I will. I love to. It's actually a word that was introduced in the 1950s in coal mines in the UK, believe it or not, because what happened with coal mines is you used to have these sort of little self-managing crews that would go down and collect mine and so on. And then technology came along and they tried to sort of introduce assembly line types of models into coal mining, right, for efficiency, just like everyone's doing with AI right now, for efficiency. But it was pretty much a disaster. All sorts of consequences happened. It was very rigid system, you know, instead of the sort of flexible hand type of approach. It caused arguments. They had to invent managers. They didn't have managers before that, and so on and so forth. And this led the researchers to say what's happened here is that the approach has been purely technical. So we install this new technology into this system, this work system of coal mining, from a purely technical perspective. What hasn't happened is there hasn't been any attention to the social, by which we mean leadership, work design, culture, human relationships. And what we want to do is bring this idea of socio-technical back to AI and contemporary technologies, because we see the exact same phenomenon of all the attention going to technology. You know, we've got $1 billion a day apparently being invested in technology, advancing technology, building the technology. What percent of investment is actually going into the things I'm talking about, building it into the workflow, putting in place the guardrails to make sure that we're not getting catastrophes and creating meaningful human work that, you know, that people can learn in and grow in. There's enormous benefit from good work. We don't want to strip that away.
Who is responsible for job design in an organisation?
Actually, I always talk about it as being a multi-party responsibility because to some extent it's the structure of the work itself, whether you work in a team or whether you work individually, those things. But it's also what your leader does. If you have a leader that's a micromanager, for example, that's going to change your work design because you're probably not going to have very much autonomy. It's also those bigger systems in the workplace, the human resource policies, things like, do you have a policy around flexible work or not? What are you rewarded for? What's focused on in the promotion system? Those things are going to shape work design because if the only way you can get promoted is working 100 hours a week, that's going to influence the demands that you have in your work. And then, of course, the individual worker has a role to play in their own work design. You know, I often say about academics, and it's true in many professional jobs, we're our own worst enemy, right? Because, you know, we often say yes to too many things, and so we overload ourselves. And then again, that makes the demands too big in our work. So it's not one group or other. It's all of those parties play a role in shaping work design.
You're listening to This Working Life on ABC Radio National. I'm Lisa Leong. My guest is Professor Sharon Parker, Director of the Centre for Transformative Work Design at Curtin University. Later, how to get cracking on redesigning your current job with the SMART model. Let's hear from someone who works in this space about the challenges of implementing AI into job design.
My name's Helena. I'm the CEO and co-founder of a company called GoFigure. And we've built a model that maps the impact of AI on jobs at the task and skill level so organisations can see what's actually most likely to change and for who and to start planning for this. We worked recently with a large global insurer. The CTO presented this amazing AI strategy that was 40 pages long, incredible detail, but had only added 4 bullet points to the workforce plan and hadn't consulted with the HR or people team at all. And that provoked quite an emotional response, given that this is the future of just under 20,000 people.
Sharon, can you respond to what Helena has pointed out for us?
That really just dovetails with this concept of socio-technical. Because there's no way that you're going to bring about change in my work, my colleagues' work, the bigger system, unless you're looking at issues like culture, workflow, leadership, skills, which is the socio, this idea that the 40-page document by the CEO, but not even talking to the workforce. Well, first of all, that I fully agree is a big problem. We've seen that for decades with all sorts of technology. We see that even with work, any sort of some sorts of work design, that they are done without the experts. And in my opinion, the experts are the people who do the work. They're the people who do it day in, day out. They know how it works. And if you try to do it without those experts, then you're sort of doomed for failure. And also, you're creating a world in which people are going to be worried, because they're not involved, they're not engaged in the process. They've got no agency over the change. So there have been some nice examples of predictive policing being implemented. And one of the investigators in our QUIDA team, our Centre of Excellence team, focuses on this particular technology. But, it actually takes years to get it to be successful of, you know, the data scientists working with the police officers, each trying to understand what's going wrong, what's working, where are the inaccuracies, you know, because, for example, to begin with, it was sending police officers out to possible crime spots at 6 o'clock in the morning. Well, why was it doing that? Because when there were break-ins and things like that and people didn't know when it was, they would just say from 6 till 6. And so, you know, AI doesn't know that, well, actually it's probably not going to be six in the morning. So this is a small, tiny thing. But who knows that? The police officers know that it's not 6 o'clock in the morning. So you've got to involve the people who are going to use this technology in the process of change. And that's where you'll get the benefit.
Sharon, you and your team have come up with a model for work design. It's called SMART. That's an acronym, of course. Tell us about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and the reason that we developed this model was because actually over the years, people have learned, you know, I gave already the example of the importance of autonomy, which was sort of stripped out of jobs in the Industrial Revolution. But people have learned about all sorts of different aspects of work that matter psychologically for people. And, you know, there were sort of more than 30 of them. And then when you go to leaders and say, hey, design could work, they're like, oh, I don't know where to start. So what the SMART model was a sort of, we did some fancy statistics to sort of boil it down to the five core things that really, really make a difference psychologically and for people's well-being and performance in work. So the first one is stimulating. And so this is about the importance of having work that is interesting, meaningful, varied, challenging. Second one is mastery. This is this idea that people need to know what it is that they're actually doing when they go to work. Now, that might sound like it's so obvious, surely you don't need to worry about that. It covers things like, do you have role clarity? Do you get feedback on how well you're performing? Do you know where your job sits in the bigger picture of things? So just to give an example, we've done a lot of research with aged care, and actually role clarity was really low in this. And we were sort of like, well, why? Isn't it obvious what you need to do? But the issue actually was not so much they didn't know what to do. They didn't know what to prioritise of the millions of things that they were meant to do. They're really meant to care for people, but they have to fill out forms, they have to liaise with families, they have to sit in meetings, you know. And so the challenge with mastery there was, how do we prioritise of all these millions of things? A is, I've already talked about autonomy. Sometimes we call it agency so that we don't confuse it with machine autonomy, human agency. And that comes back to a fundamental human need that we have, which is to be able to control and shape and influence our world. R is for relational. Again, this comes back to a fundamental human need. And that's a need that we discovered, I think, during COVID, and that is the need to connect with other human beings. And work is a powerful source of connection, right? We're connecting right now, you know, in our work. And so we can design work to deliberately really ensure that people have got the social contact, the support that they need, maybe be part of a bigger picture, be part of a team. These sorts of aspects make relational work. And then the last one, which I always call the big one, is T, and that is T for tolerable. And this is about having demands at work that are manageable. It's not about having no demands. So sometimes managers think we're trying to eradicate all demands from work, but that's basically trying to eradicate work, right? Because yeah. Work has demands. That's sort of the definition of work. You've got to put in effort. But whatever those demands are, they could be thinking demands, cognitive, they could be time pressure demands, they could be emotional demands. Whatever the demands are in your work, they can be physical, they have to be tolerable, they have to be what you can manage. And sometimes people get overwhelmed with long work hours or you know, traumatic situations or, you know, a boss that's harassing them or whatever. And then, of course, the demands are no longer tolerable.
So SMART, stimulating, mastery, agency, relational and tolerable demands. Sharon, somebody, a leader, might be listening and going, oh, that sounds really nice, but that's hard. And I don't know whether I've got time for this. So if you were trying to address that, why bother?
Because not only is it good for well-being and mental health of people, so first of all, there's a duty of care that employers have these days. There are, especially in Australia now, very clear regulations that you cannot cause harm to workers, including psychological harm. And those factors are all linked to work stress if you don't have them. So number one, there is a regulatory requirement to care about this stuff these days. But I would always say, and when we work with organisations, we try to probably shift the emphasis away from compliance with regulation because we don't want to just get a tick box type of response. I would always say, actually, when you've got smart work, you're going to have innovative workers, creative workers, motivated, engaged workers who are going to work harder and put in better quality work. They're going to want to stay with your organisation, so you're not going to be constantly churn and burn. You know, so there is 100 years of research showing that these factors matter for organisational outcomes as well. So there's a stick, which is the regulatory component, but there's a carrot, and the carrot is very compelling. So, and as I said right at the beginning, you know, I think that we can create work that is both of those things, both healthy and productive.
So let's say I wanted to apply the SMART model to my job working with my manager in HR. Where do we start? And then maybe you could just sort of bring out some of the factors in an example or two, Sharon.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, this whole field of AI is complex, right? But I think one really simple thing that we could do is when AI is being implemented within a work system, as well as the usual focus on, you know, is it delivering efficiency? Is it delivering benefit for the customer? Those are important things, right? But what is the impact of that AI on the humans doing the work? And let's use the SMART model to understand that. So is it changing work so that it's making it really, really boring, so they're stimulating? Because as I said before, sometimes these changes mean you go from being an active worker to someone watching a screen. What's the impact on your job? What's the impact on your tolerable work? Is it actually adding more demands to your work? So a very simple thing would be to simply say, as we work on this technology and implement it, let's not just look at the end user benefits. Let's look at its impact on the workers and let's evaluate that. Let's talk about that. Let's make that part of the criteria for success for AI.
Sharon, we have this segment at the end of the show. It's called Try This. And each week we get people to do one thing, an experiment during the week, to bring what we've been talking about to life. So let's say a manager and a leader are thinking about utilising the SMART model and they want to kick it off. What is your one thing that they can actually do to start this process or to do something around this model?
I think the first thing, the simplest thing, might even be to apply it to their own job. So just literally go through SMART and how are they going on those aspects themselves? Because actually, before people start, leaders start designing work, thinking about other people's work, you know, it's useful to take stock of their own work. Because if you're already overloaded, exhausted, it's going to be very hard for you to even have the time to think about other people's work design. So I would just very simply, to get used to the model, apply it to your own work.
And actually there's a free assessment link which I found, and we could put a link up in our show notes as well. Is that a good thing to try?
Very simple way to do it. Just takes about 3 minutes and it's just, you can diagnose your own SMART work.
Well, thanks for all the good work that you do, Sharon.
Thank you, Lisa. It's been lovely to talk with you.
And you can email us at thisworkinglife@abc.net.au and we'll send you a link to the free assessment tool for the SMART model. Professor Sharon Parker is the Director of the Centre for Transformative Work Design at Curtin University. And she's also the Director for the newly created Centre of Excellence for Quality Work in the Digital Age. Watch this space for more. Thanks for listening to This Working Life. It was produced by Michelle Weeks and engineered by Tim James on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Nam, Melbourne. If you'd like to hear more from us, you can like or subscribe to our show on ABC Listen or anywhere you get your podcasts. And please share the love as well. Send it to a friend or a colleague you think would enjoy This Working Life as much as you. I'm Lisa Leong. Until next time, love your work.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.